Hello, everyone. I'm Gilbert Cruz, and this is the Book Review Podcast, where we're continuing to highlight great conversations from our decade-plus archive. I know we have many longtime listeners of this show who are eager for new episodes. I know this because a not small number of those listeners have made their opinions very clear by emailing us at books@nytimes.com, which you should continue to do. So we'll have a few new episodes coming in December, the annual announcement of our top 10 books of the year, which we often record as a live event, and a conversation with our staff critics about their year in reading. So stay tuned for those episodes. Today, we have a pair of interviews with nonfiction authors. The first, from March 2021, is with Mark Harris, and it's about his biography of the film and theater director Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols' A Life is Mark's third nonfiction book focused on film. His first, Pictures at a Revolution, about the films nominated for Best Picture in 1967, remains one of my absolute favorite books on film.
Mark Harris joins us now from New York. He is the author of several books, including Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, and Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, and now a biography of Mike Nichols. Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like most people know who Mike Nichols was. But that might just be because I'm such a huge fan, it's impossible for me to imagine that people wouldn't. But for those who don't know, tell us about who Mike Nichols was.
Very briefly, a movie director who made The Graduate, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Silkwood, and Working Girl, had a 50-year career making movies, but at the same time, had a 50-year career directing theater. Everything from the first production of The Odd Couple to The Real Thing to Spamalot. And before either of those 50-year careers, he was a very successful performing artist whose partnership with Elaine May kind of changed and reinvented improv comedy.
How did you come to write this biography? This is your first single individual biography.
I knew Mike, first of all, because my husband, Tony Kushner, worked with him on the HBO adaptation of Angels in America. That was starting at around 2000 or 2001. And then The Graduate was a very big part of my first book. So I had spent time interviewing him, aside from social time with him, and asking him about his career. And I hadn't ever really thought of writing a biography of him or really of anyone. I don't think of myself as a biographer, but after he passed away at the end of 2014, I just really started to think this would be a life I could spend years literally exploring.
What were the specific challenges of writing a biography for you, and specifically of writing his biography?
Well, there were so many. I think for one thing, it was a challenge that I had never done it before. I was used to, in my other books, having a bunch of characters to play with and a bunch of plot lines, so that when one storyline went dry, I always had something to cut away to. And you don't have that luxury in a biography. You're tied to one life. And so I was scared that there would be places that I couldn't understand in his life, or places where nothing much happened. That happily turned out not to be true. A huge challenge was just the sheer number of people I wanted to interview. I ended up talking to about 250 people, but I didn't stop because I ran out of people. I really could have kept going. It was just time to start writing. And another challenge peculiar to him, and I guess peculiar to me, was going in, I was really unsure how I was going to write about Angels in America, because I have a personal connection to that and personal knowledge of how it unfolded in a way that I don't for other subjects of the book. And I was unsure about how I would write about The Graduate, because I had written about it before and was very worried that I would run the risk of making my storytelling about that feel kind of warmed over.
How did you first encounter his work as a viewer? And then I'm curious, too, to hear what it was like when you first met him for that first book.
I think the nice story would be to say that I first encountered his work by seeing The Graduate, because that's where most people start. But the uglier truth is that the first Mike Nichols movie I saw was The Day of the Dolphin.
Not one of his greats.
Not one of his greats. He used to call it the fish movie. He was not a fan. But I'm in my mid-50s, and for people my age, that's the first Mike Nichols movie that came out that kids could see. It was in 1973. And so that was probably my first encounter, but my first encounter when I was old enough to understand that movies are directed by people was definitely The Graduate. I think I saw it in high school.
All right, I have to ask you, what did you make of the Fish movie?
Oh, when I was 9? I loved it. I mean, I had no problem with a story about dolphins being trained to assassinate the president of the United States and talking to each other and talking to people. I thought that seems like a completely reasonable plot line.
I have a theory, and it could be completely wrong, so feel free to puncture it, but that people who respond to the name Mike Nichols with an, you know, oh my God, I love him, are really responding that way, mostly because of Nichols and May.
I think that's right. I really do, especially for an older generation.
Wait. Stop there. I'm not an older generation, but keep going.
I think for people who know about Nichols and May, that's their first association. Absolutely. It's certainly their first association with him as a personality. But I've been really surprised in talking about the book and talking to people about his work, how many people don't even know that that part of his career existed.
That's crazy to me, because back in the day, for those of us who are not old, but maybe slightly older than others, you had to go to the Museum of TV and Radio to watch old Nichols and May. But now, you know, with YouTube, you could just watch all of it at any moment. So it feels like, why doesn't everyone know about this?
Right. And you can download all three of their records that they made very easily. And so it's been lovely to introduce people to that, because I think the work is still so great. Like, nothing about it to me is dated. It's still incredibly funny and perceptive and sharp. Even if you can't see them, even if you can only listen, it's great.
You interviewed him, not for this book, for the previous book. I'm curious, how open was he as an interviewer? Obviously, you were speaking to him specifically about his work, not really about his life. But did he bring in elements of his personal life into those interviews?
Oh, yeah. I thought he was remarkably open. You know, it's always a kind of occupational hazard, I think, of a writer who is talking about a successful movie or a successful play from a long time ago, that everything you hear is a victory lap and everything is encrusted with a little too much ornamentation that even the teller can't tell anymore if it really happened or if it's just something that has helped burnish the story. There are a few bigger success stories for a director to look back on than The Graduate. And I was asking Mike about it 40 years and probably 40,000 questions after it happened. But I was so impressed by his willingness to come at it from new angles, to re-examine things that he hadn't thought about for a while, to tell stories that were frankly not flattering to him. I mean, I've never heard harsher stories about Mike's behavior over the years than I heard from Mike himself. So he was an extraordinary interview subject. And of course, the downside of that is that every day I worked on the book, I thought of a new question that I wish I had had the chance to ask him.
What would you have wanted to ask him?
Oh my gosh. Sometimes it's as simple as, okay, really, why did you want to do this movie? I know why you said you wanted to do it at the time, but what really attracted you? So much of what I was going after was the why of it. All of the research I did was really just toward the goal of understanding his motivations for things and understanding his world. I mean, I found this quote from Mike early on that became kind of the star I steered by, which is, it was actually about directing. And he said that the two big jobs of a director are to render the events of the play or the movie lucid and understandable, to make it clear what this was really like. Whatever situation it is, whatever was happening, what was it really like? And the other thing that a director does is always to keep track of what happens next. And those sort of became the questions that I used to propel me through the book. What was this really like, no matter where we were in his life? And then what happens next? And why did it happen next? Like, how did event B emerge out of event A?
So it's interesting that those questions are mostly about the work, not so much about him.
I think they were about his life too. I mean, he was married 4 times.
Right.
And definitely a question I had was, so why did that second marriage, which is very short and tumultuous, why did that happen? You know, questions like that were absolutely front of mind as well. And also were questions that I asked people who knew him at the time. And sometimes it was interesting. Sometimes I would get a really clear explanation from someone that I never would have thought of. And other times the answer would be, beats me. I was there at the time. We have no idea what he was thinking.
Huh. Well, I want to talk to you about his fourth wife, Diane Sawyer, who you did speak to for this book. But let's actually talk about some of those other interviews first, because you interviewed, as you said, around, you know, 250 people from Meryl Streep to Candace Bergen to Robert Redford to Gloria Steinem. I'm curious which interviews were the most insightful and maybe perhaps surprising that challenged your perception of him.
Well, certainly my interview with Elaine May was completely critical to my understanding of him, because the farther back you go in someone's life, the fewer people there are to talk to. And when you're writing about someone who did a lot of movies and did a lot of plays, you kind of have the luxury of a safety net. You can think, well, if one person from this play won't talk to me, others will. And if none of the actors will talk to me, maybe the designer will talk to me. But for the Nichols and May years, there was one person who could shed light on how he became who he was and how he thought. And if she didn't agree to talk to me, there was really nowhere else to go with that. So everything that Elaine May said to me was a revelation. And I really mean that literally, because she's given so few serious interviews about their process and their work together over the last 50 years that was really, really important to me. And other than that, the great value for me came from people who had worked with him more than once and knew him over many years. People like Meryl Streep, who had made, I think, 3 or 4 movies and done a play with him and been close to him from the early 1980s until his death.
Starting with Silkwood,
but through Heartburn and Postcards from the Edge and The Seagull on Stage and Angels in America. And then even at the time Mike died, he was actively preparing a film version of the Terrence McNally play Masterclass that she was going to star in for HBO.
Let's go back to Elaine May, because she never talks to anyone. How did you persuade her?
You know, before I started the book, I got the consent of Diane Sawyer and of Mike's 3 children. They didn't promise that they would do interviews or anything like that, but they gave their consent for me to do the book, and they gave, just as importantly, their consent for me to make public that they had given their consent. And I think that that made a difference to Elaine May. I don't think that she would have done it without that. I think it made a difference to her that Mike liked my work, that he had liked Pictures at a Revolution, the parts about The Graduate. So I guess, you know, she felt I was legitimate. And if she thought that Mike would have wanted her to do it, that might have really mattered to her, because she told me at one point, you know, that especially after their partnership broke up, after their rift had healed, they really tried never to say no to each other. So maybe in a way, she was saying yes to Mike in doing the interview, not just yes to me.
This is probably a good moment to bring up Mike's flops, of which he had many, perhaps not surprising because he also had so many successes. How did he handle failure?
You know, I spend a lot of time on his failures in the book, and it's not because I have morbid curiosity about like exactly all of the ways in which The Day of the Dolphin went wrong, although I do have that morbid curiosity. It's that I think why you have a failure and how you respond to it and how you recover from it and how you look at it are all essential parts of being an artist, especially if you're going to have any kind of long-term career. You are going to fail once, more than once, frequently. And the way Mike Nichols handled it was, to me, pretty inspiring. I mean, from his first failure, which was Catch-22, a very expensive movie. He had an unlimited budget. It was a commercial flop after a string of successes and not really critically well-received either.
Although I feel like there are people now who are saying maybe it wasn't so bad. Like there seems to be a little revival or sort of revisionist view of it.
Absolutely. Steven Soderbergh is a big fan of the movie. And Mike himself kind of blew hot and cold in later years. There were times when he would say it's flop, and there were times when he'd say, you know, there are things I did in that movie that I really liked. But what happened when the movie flopped, and it certainly flopped at the time, was he almost felt relieved. He had wondered for so long what it would be like to have a big public failure. And so the sense that he had almost instantly was, well, I survived. It didn't kill me. I'm still here. And his instinct was to turn to something small and not particularly commercial, just because he really loved it. And in this case, that was Carnal Knowledge, which ended up becoming a big success. But that was a pattern that he returned to over and over and over again. When you have a big failure, he felt the thing to do is turn to something you love, something that you don't have big expectations for, just something that you want to do for its own sake. And I think that's really admirable. And I'm always touched by the fact that late into his life, into his late 70s, when he had a failure, he was never defensive about it. I mean, he could be really hurt by bad reviews. He was very plugged into the New York Times. If the Times didn't like something he did, that went right to the quick, as it does for a lot of people. But he was almost never defensive about it. And, you know, when he had The Country Girl on Broadway with Frances McDormand and Morgan Freeman, a revival of a play that was not well received by anyone and that was not his best work, honestly. He had heart surgery right after that. This was around 2008. And as he recovered, he took out a legal pad and started making a list of the things he felt he had done wrong with that production. And to me, if you're spending a lot of time writing the life of an artist, I just find that incredibly heartening that in your late 70s, you would be open to looking at your own mistakes and thinking, how am I going to do better next time? I find that really moving. There was never any resting on his laurels in Mike's career.
Well, we obviously don't have time to talk about everything Mike Nichols, but I want to ask one last thing. He was a complicated person, clearly. And one thing that interests me is that just like he had those great successes and those huge flops, people loved him, but he also could be difficult and mean. I think it sounds like people were pretty open about that. So I'm curious, and let's end on an upbeat. So we'll start with, what were the sort of the difficult sides of Mike Nichols, both personally and professionally? And then let's end on what his friends and his people would say about him that were his greatest strengths and qualities.
Well, yeah, I certainly didn't want to shy from the difficult side because it was there. And it would manifest itself not in explosions of temper, but in nastiness, in a little bit of cruelty, in coldness, in disdain. The bad side of Mike was that, especially really early in his career, he could be very rough, for instance, on his film crews. Or one actor would rub him the wrong way and become the target of one nasty remark after another. And that was something that Mike had spoken to me about very openly, that he was really ashamed of it. And he sort of viewed the journey of his life as a process of work to overcome that side of himself, which he really, to a great extent, did well before I met him. You know, even when he married Diane Sawyer, which was in 1987 or 88, he told the producer of Working Girl, which he was working on at the time, I need someone in my life who will kick my ass when I'm rude to a cab driver. And if I don't have that, I'm doomed. So it was really something that he understood was a problem, even if he didn't always understand how to solve it.
And the positive side?
Positive side was that, especially later in his life, for the last, you know, several decades of his life, Mike was an extraordinarily generous person. I mean, even aside from his work, where actor after actor after actor talked about him with this incredible reverence because he was able to look into them and figure out exactly what they specifically needed to find their performance, just in ways that had nothing to do with work, he was incredibly kind. There were probably at least half a dozen actresses from Mary Louise Parker to Natalie Portman, who viewed him as a kind of mentor, like a kindly uncle or even grandfather. His personal generosity to people was extraordinary. I mean, I did not put a lot of it in the book, but that was really because over and over again, I would talk to someone who would say something like, and he gave me $10,000 when I really needed it. Or, and when I was sick, he just let me stay in his guest house for weeks until I recovered. You know, they asked that stuff not be in the book, so it isn't. But his kindness and his generosity, both professionally and personally, were legendary for the last 20 or 30 years of his life.
All right, we have to end it there, but hopefully people will read the book, watch all the movies, even the flops, go online and listen to all Nichols and May. And I don't know, what did I leave out? Can you see any of his things on theater?
It's pretty hard. I mean, you can, if you're in New York, you can go to the Performing Arts Library and watch some of them. But, you know, that's the heartbreaking thing about theater. It's kind of largely lost to history. But the movies are pretty much all available.
All right. Mark, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Harris's new biography is Mike Nichols, A Life.
Our second interview is with writer Adam Higginbotham from April 2019. His Midnight in Chernobyl is something I listened to during the first year of the pandemic in audiobook format on early weekend mornings while doing my grocery shopping. It sounded like the most detailed podcast one could ever hope for on this terrible nuclear disaster, full of both detail and drama.
Adam Higginbotham joins us now. His new book is called Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what drew you to the subject of Chernobyl?
Well, initially, when I started reporting on the subject back in 2006, I was interested in finding out the stories of people who'd been eyewitnesses to what had happened. And I was kind of inspired by the fact that I'd recently read Walter Lord's A Night to Remember.
About the Titanic.
About the sinking of the Titanic, which is this, you know, incredible and concise book, which reconstructs just the night of the sinking of the Titanic through interviews that Lord conducted in the years after the sinking with people who'd survived. And I'd read the existing literature on the Chernobyl accident, and I just thought that there was this really great opportunity to write, you know, a long magazine piece that reconstructed the night in the words of the people or through the experiences of the people that had been there. But then when I began interviewing them, I realized that, you know, the existing accounts had huge holes in them and didn't really reflect the full reality of what had happened. And then I went back again to Ukraine to do further reporting on the story in 2011, around the 25th anniversary of the accident. And during that visit, I did some things during the reporting that really frightened me. And, you know, I remember sitting in this hotel room in the town of Chernobyl and looking out the window and thinking, I'm never going to come back to this terrible place.
What frightened you?
Oh, I just went into the most radioactive area of the entire exclusion zone. But when I emerged, I realized that I'd got no real sense of what my dose had been. So I had a real insight into how terrifying the kind of the prospect of radiation can be and how insidious the fear it generates is.
But you're in protective gear, right?
No. There's no protective gear that you can wear that would protect you from anything other than the dust. So I was just wearing my regular clothes. You know, I was outside in a forest and just walking around, but there was no protective gear. So I swore in 2011 I'd never go back. And then about 3 years later, I found myself sitting at my desk producing another pitch about a third magazine story. And at that point, I eventually began thinking, well, you know, maybe there's a wider project here.
What kept drawing you back?
I think to begin with, the stories of the people that I spoke to back in 2006 kind of wouldn't let go of me. And then I began to realize the sort of epic scale of the story, because most of the literature that had been published before I began work on this had concentrated on specific aspects of what had happened. So, you know, there were books that talked about the night of the accident and reconstructed in technical detail what happened. And there were books that talked about the ecological aftermath. And there was a lot of, you know, scientific writing about it. And there's Svetlana Alexeyevich's Voices from Chernobyl, which is this sort of, isn't a narrative book, but as a kind of, you know, hallucinatory sense of what it was like for these individuals, but many of whom are unnamed, to have suffered through the accident. But what I wanted to do was to write a character-driven narrative that took the story right from the beginning of the project back in 1970 to the present day. And I realized that there were specific characters within that huge story who could carry the tale through from beginning to end. And if I could find those people and talk to them in enough detail, then I could tell a story unlike any version of the Chernobyl story that I'd read before.
What was it that those people were saying to you that stuck with you? I mean, that you were hearing in their stories that made you want to come back?
I think partly to begin with, it was the fact that I realized that they were not these sort of Slavic stereotypes of drab victims of the socialist experiment. When I started visiting people in Moscow and in Kiev, you know, I began to realize that I had been just as much of a victim of propaganda about what life was like in the Soviet Union as anybody who lived in the Soviet Union at the time of the accident would have been of what life was like in the West. And I was 17 when the accident happened. And some of these guys and some of these women were not much older than me at the time. And so as I began to kind of go into the detail of their stories and most importantly, their background before the accident and their sort of aspirations and expectations of what the future was going to be like, I realized that they were a lot like me. And it was my wish to kind of bring to life these people as real characters, as real people, that kept drawing me back.
All right. So given that you were terrified after that second visit because of the exposure, how many times did you go back? And were you nervous then about, worried about the long-term health implications?
The honest answer is I don't actually know how many times I went back. Enough to lose count of how many times I went back. And I never really stopped being afraid of it. Only because, although eventually I did get my own dosimeter, so I could keep track of how much radiation I was absorbing with each visit and cumulatively over all that time, you know, the complexities of radiation exposure are such that, you know, somebody like me does not really know what the effect is going to be. But I should say that radiation exposure inside the exclusion zone now, even in the worst places, is pretty minimal and is not going to really hurt you over the long term, as far as I know.
As far as you know. Well, let's go back to what happened at Chernobyl and how much of what happened did we know at the time. So let's go, for those who were not 17, maybe weren't even born in 1986, what happened exactly?
What happened was that on the night of April the 25th into the morning of April the 26th, there was a long-delayed safety test that they were going to be carrying out on this reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl plant. And during the course of this safety test that was being conducted during a regular maintenance shutdown, the operators of the reactor inadvertently brought it into a state of extreme instability, which on its own would have been fine. But there were also a series of serious design defects with the reactor that stretched back more than 10 years. The designers of the reactor had known about it all this time, but didn't bother really informing anybody about it, and certainly didn't bother addressing. And so these design defects and the mistakes made by the operators of the reactor combined in this kind of deadly chain of events and a series of things that individually would not have caused an accident eventually piled up to the point where at the end of the test, which lasted only 36 seconds, when the reactor operator pressed the button to shut the reactor down, one of the most important design defects in the reactor was that the control rods that are designed to shut down the reactor when you press this button, for a fraction of a second, could actually increase power inside the reactor instead of decreasing it. And because of everything else that had happened up to that point, at the moment when those control rods began descending into the reactor, they set off a chain reaction that was unstoppable. And that led to an explosion, blew the top off the reactor, destroyed the roof of the reactor building, two of the walls of the reactor building, and released this pillar of radioactive contamination into the atmosphere that 3 days later ended up in Sweden. And that was how the world discovered that this accident had happened.
What does something like this look like, right? Because for most people, they think of nuclear power, they think of a nuclear bomb, they think of a mushroom cloud, they think of, you know, a massive disaster that's readily apparent. But this is different. What does it look like? And give us a sense of the scale.
To me, the descriptions of what it looked like that were given to me by the people who were there are actually kind of worse than the imaginary vision of a nuclear accident with a mushroom cloud and stuff. You know, this building was utterly destroyed and looks in photographs as if it had been kind of scooped out by a giant spoon from above. So the building is surrounded by blackened wreckage. In daylight, you could see that there was a wisp of steam or white smoke of some kind wafting out of the top of the building. But what the operators who went out into the street to look at the building immediately after the explosion saw was much, much more frightening, which was this pillar of ethereal blue-white light shooting upwards into the atmosphere, off into infinity. And this was an indication that they'd got a nuclear reactor that was uncovered to the atmosphere.
What was the scale of the disaster? I mean, how much radiation got released and how many people were killed in the immediate explosion?
In the immediate part of the accident, the answer is a lot fewer than most people expect. You know, one man was killed in the course of the explosion, and a second operator died in hospital shortly before dawn from burns he'd sustained immediately after the explosion. And then I think within 5 months, a further 29 people had died in hospital in Moscow or in Kiev from radiation exposure that they took during the hours after the explosion itself or in attempting to fight the fires that broke out as a result of the explosion. But the long-term effects of the radiation in the environment are a much more controversial question. And, you know, in the years since the accident, arguments have developed that have become quite fundamentalist on both sides. So you'll get boosters of the nuclear industry who will tell you that, you know, 65 people have died in total as a result of the accident. You know, and then you'll have environmental groups that will tell you that hundreds of thousands of people have died of cancer and other diseases as a result. But there's a lot of scientific study has been done on this. And what the science suggests is that out of a population of 5 million people living in the worst affected areas of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia, there will be an estimated 5,000 deaths from cancer that would not have happened had this explosion not taken place. And in the broader area, there'll be another 25,000 cancers that will not be fatal that can be attributed to the accident. But the truth is that all of these things are estimates. And in the confusion and the deliberate attempts of the Soviet government to cover things up after the accident happened, data was either not gathered or deliberately concealed, which would have helped us reach better conclusions.
So we know that the world didn't find out about it until Sweden noticed radiation in the atmosphere. Presumably, the people that were there immediately knew right away that something seriously wrong had happened. To what extent was Russia aware, and how actively did they suppress the knowledge of what happened from people in Russia, people in the Ukraine at the time?
Well, to begin with, there was a lot of confusion. And I think, you know, from speaking to those people who were there at the time and in charge, they simply couldn't comprehend the enormity of what had happened. And, you know, they simply refused to believe it. And when Gorbachev and the members of the Politburo really began to find out that something terrible had happened, they convened what Gorbachev subsequently in his memoirs described as an emergency Politburo meeting. Mm-hmm. But he regarded it apparently as such an emergency that although the accident happened early on Saturday morning, the meeting took place on Monday morning at 10:30. And then in the discussion that they had there, they debated whether or not they should be completely open about what had happened or whether they should take what was regarded as the traditional route, which was to release a kind of three-line statement that said that something bad had happened, but it was all being taken care of. And, you know, whatever Gorbachev's intentions toward glasnost and perestroika were at that time, they decided to take the traditional approach, which was to try and sit on it for as long as possible.
There's a city next to it. Is it Pripyat? Is
that That's right, yeah.
Pripyat. How many people were living there? Who was there? What was it like before this disaster? And were they immediately evacuated? What ended up happening to that place?
Well, this is something that I was particularly interested to explore in the reporting because it was something that had been written about very little before, what life was like in Pripyat before the accident. And there were almost 50,000 people living there. But it was, you know, it was regarded as a really nice place to live because it was intended as a kind of magnet community to attract nuclear specialists from around the Soviet Union.
Is it one-third children?
That's right. The average age of the population was 26, and a third of those were children. And it was, you know, it was an extremely modern, well-appointed place with a scuba diving club, a beauty parlor, its own football team, these modern, newly built apartments that you could get without having to wait on a waiting list. But the people that lived there were not informed that an accident had taken place immediately after the explosion. And they weren't evacuated until almost 36 hours after it had taken place. And this was partly because the Soviet government simply didn't want to admit what had happened. And if they had 50,000 people being evacuated from a city, it would be pretty hard to keep a lid on that information because it would just leak out into the wider part of the country, and then pretty soon people in the West would hear about it. But the people in the city also had been party to information about accidents before. There had been accidents happen at the Chernobyl plant before. And initially, they, as word began to leak into the city about what had happened in the reactor, which was only 3 kilometers away, nobody was that worried about it because before accidents had happened, but there had been no terrible consequences. So although, you know, there are some versions of the story that would have you believe that these people were deliberately kept in the dark and, you know, they were terrible victims of what had happened, the truth is that they themselves were not that concerned about it when they first heard what had happened. Then they just thought that this was another accident which would be cleared up soon enough, and then they could just go back to their normal lives.
Well, you say like just another accident. I mean, were accidents common in the Soviet Union at that time, nuclear power plant accidents?
Accidents of all kinds were common in the Soviet Union at that time. But there had been a fairly major accident, although obviously not one on this scale, at Chernobyl in 1982, which had resulted in radioactive leaks from the plant. But that had been successfully covered up, and they quietly resurfaced the main street leading into Pripyat to cover up the contamination that had fallen there. And just everybody else got on with it and went about their lives as usual.
And yet Chernobyl, in the international imagination or memory, it stands out among nuclear disasters. Why is that? I mean, was it particularly huge in its scale? Was it because of the cover-up? Why is it different from other major nuclear accidents that have occurred?
Because this is the biggest and most devastating nuclear accident in history. Even Fukushima cannot really compare in the amount of radioactivity that was released into the atmosphere. I mean, the biggest difference is the number of people whose lives were upset, overturned, or destroyed by what happened. But I think partly the fascination that people have with it is that it did take place within the Soviet Union at a time when, you know, everything that happened there was something of a mystery. And the cover-up sort of backfired because the Soviet government's attempts to squelch information escaping from Moscow and Kiev meant that the rumors just became much worse. So that, you know, the New York Post published a story in the week after the accident saying that 15,000 people had been killed in this explosion and their bodies buried in a huge pit as radioactive waste somewhere in Ukraine. And those kind of facts, or would-be facts that emerged at the time of the accident, kind of stuck in the public consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so people, even now, you know, when I was working on the book and I'd be talking to people at parties and they'd ask me what I was working on, their first question would be, so how many thousand people really died?
Yeah.
You know, and so that misconception alone has really took hold in people's minds.
You mentioned earlier that there were structural problems with the plant, safety issues that were, you know, existed from the construction of the site itself. So was this an accident waiting to happen? I mean, was it kind of inevitable that something like this would occur?
Yes. I mean, in the post-accident analysis that the Politburo had done, you know, they eventually concluded that if it hadn't happened in Chernobyl, then it would have happened at another nuclear plant using this model of reactor somewhere else. And more broadly, kind of Soviet industry and the Soviet state really operated on the basis that there would be no tomorrow, mm-hmm. that they could just keep abusing the environment and they could keep building these shoddy enterprises and everything would work out in the end. And, you know, what happened was that tomorrow finally arrived in Chernobyl.
So the question then is, I mean, how worried should we be now? Because that was not the only plant built during that era, right?
Right.
In the Soviet
That's true.
Union. I mean, Have they gone back and sort of examined the construction of other nuclear plants that are still in operation and made corrections?
Interestingly, what they did in the immediate aftermath of the accident was they tried to conceal information about all of these design defects in order to cover up for the heads of the nuclear industry who were responsible for this. Simultaneously, they launched a series of modifications to address the design defects. So while on one hand they were denying that there was any problem with the reactor, on the other hand, they made all these modifications to address the design defects in the reactor. And in fact, there are 11 RBMK reactors still in operation inside Russia at the moment. And I think they're now extending the lifespan of some of these.
Well, that's reassuring. It is a very gripping story, hopefully one not to occur again. The book, again, is called Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster by Adam Higginbotham.
Those were our conversations with Mark Harris from 2021 and Adam Higginbotham from 2019. We'll have more from the Book Review Podcast archive next week. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Thank you for listening.